Once more unto the breach, dear friends, else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, everyone, ladies, gentlemen, and those strange boys and girls that like to listen to economics programs, if you exist. Good morning to you all, and this is Jake McClure. This is the Personal Wealth Coach, and joining me via telecommunication today is the elder baldy Jeffrey McClure, and let's see if I can pick his microphone up. Here we go. 1, 2, 3.
I'm here.
All right. It's like I have to coordinate that because the dials on this, I have to turn myself down at the same time as you go up. It's just seeing if I can keep my coordination. That's all it is.
Well, I don't think the boys and girls who listen to this radio program are strange.
That's just because you're strange.
Well, that's possible.
See, I wouldn't normally think they were strange, but other people might think they were strange for having boys and girls listening to an economics radio program on a Saturday morning.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Although in my early childhood, we listened to the radio on Saturday morning and thought it was pretty neat.
Yeah, the Lone Ranger is a little different than the Lone Arranger.
I don't know. You future economists of America, you know, there are probably children out there that will be future Nobel Prize and economics winners.
Oh, there's no doubt they exist out there, unless the Nobel Prizes go away for some reason.
And they've probably got glasses and spend a lot of time looking at numbers. And those aren't strange. The rest of the people are strange.
That's the way I look at it, too. I should have said that more clearly. The unstrange boys and girls that are listening to this program as compared to the vast majority. I'm not the weird one. It's everyone else.
You got it.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the way it works.
So we got to do some disclosures because not only are we unboring to ourselves, but not necessarily to others, we have other things to disclose as well. Do you want to take it?
Well, let's see. The Personal Wealth Coach is the name of this radio program. It's also the name of an SEC-registered investment advisory firm in Salado, based in Salado, Texas. And that's not coincidental because the two guys who are on this radio program are the two principals of that firm. And the fact that we're registered with the SEC doesn't mean they approve or disapprove of us. It just means that that's our regulator, and that's where we register. And it means that we have over $100 million under management. It doesn't mean anything more or less than that. Let's see. We advertise on KTEM, but we don't pay for this radio show. None, and they don't pay us for this radio show.
And the things that we advertise on KTEM...
For the radio show.
Yeah.
Which is an interesting conundrum.
I can tell people exactly why we're doing that, because we always allude to it being very confusing and so on. We consider this a public service. As strange as that is, one of the things that some people know about me that listen, my wife and I founded a not-for-profit, which is literally that. There's no profitability anywhere. Montessori school to educate preschoolers up through parts of elementary school. We're doing the radio program because I have people that come to talk to me that are in MBA programs, that have master's degrees in finance, and they're learning from us. There's no place to learn this stuff, and it's stuff that you just pick up with time. Unless we can throw it out there and gift it to you, the way we gift it to you makes everything better. This is part of the tenets of capitalism, is that if you educate a population, everybody's standard of living goes up. That's paraphrasing Adam Smith.
Yep.
So that's why we do it, as weird as it is.
And it's really strange, because we've got a school system that teaches a lot of higher math. And requires at least algebra for just about everybody.
But doesn't really tell you how you would use that in the real world.
But they don't teach you about how to manage your 401k.
Which you will need to do in the real world.
And I've often thought at least part of that is because the people who put the curriculum together at the university level are covered by defined benefit, guaranteed
government-sponsored through some means or another, or university-sponsored retirement plans. Yeah, they don't have to do anything. Although even those universities have 403Bs now, where you're investing internally in them.
Right, and 403Bs are among the worst as a class of retirement accounts, among the most expensive and least well-managed out there.
Now, there's some caveats around that before all of you medical professionals get too scared. Medical 403Bs are generally better than the worst 403Bs, but they are still not as well taken care of as a 401k, and by that I mean the regulations are much laxer. A 403B is issued by either a governmental organization like a school district or a nonprofit organization like most hospitals and universities. Though if you look at the executive pay, the question of profitability certainly jumps to mind. We have a very strange regulatory system, including what's considered profit and what's considered not for profit. But one thing that is certain is that 403Bs have nowhere near the protections that 401Ks do. They're still, in some cases, the best thing you can get and worth doing. There you go. There was the caveats. Now I'll throw it back to you.
Let's see. We have to say that the information that we present on this radio program is educational. It is not investment advice. Investment advice is given to individuals based on their individual circumstances, and obviously we're not giving it to individuals based on your individual circumstances when we talk about it on a radio program. It's also true that the information we get is we obtain from sources. Oh, here I get to use the word.
Here it comes.
Sources we deem reliable. But we make no warranty or guarantee as to its completeness or accuracy. How do you like that?
I like that you include both warranty and guarantee every time you do the disclosure. Like, it's not repetitive and redundant.
Well, there are different things, warranties and guarantees, according to the lawyers.
Yeah, one of them is a written document saying that you'll pay them back for doing something, and the other one is a promissory statement saying that the honor of the person is behind it. So
sometimes way behind it.
Way, way, way behind it.
And so let's talk about
and guarantee is a hard word to spell.
Yes, it is. There's too many E's.
And a weird U at the beginning. Guarantee? I don't want a guarantee. What is a guarantee? Go ahead. Let's talk of the market.
Benjamin Johnson has really messed with our language.
Yes, he has. Benjamin Johnson is a Scotsman who basically developed the first English dictionary. I guarantee that.
First widely published one, anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And he spelled words very strangely because he felt like it.
Well, everybody was spelling strangely at the time, so why not?
Okay, let's talk about the markets, like I said. This is the weirdest bull market I've ever encountered, even if it is a bull market.
If it isn't, you usually measure a bull market from a bottom and a bear market from the top. So by any stretch of the imagination, a 35% rise from the bottom sounds like a bull market, except we're not fully recovered yet.
Well, we had some interesting things happen this week. This is earnings season, and you know, a lot of companies are coming out with their earnings.
Or coming out with no earnings.
Yeah, they're coming out with negative earnings. They're coming out losing a lot of money. And even the ones that are making a lot of money are saying, we're not giving any guidance for the future because we don't have a clue what we'll earn in the future. And normally, the future estimates of earnings are the things that drive the market. And when you have... I don't know the exact numbers, but as I was looking through the companies that reported this week, at least half of them declined to give guidance as to future earnings. Normally, that would cause a massive sell-off in the market. And then China comes along, the second largest economic entity on the planet, and says, we're not making any forecasts for what our GDP is going to be.
Right.
Because we don't know. We don't know what it's going to be.
And let me just be really pedantic, because that's what economists do, and say that China's the second largest single-defined country entity on the planet, economically speaking. But the European Union creeps up there, actually larger than the United States when considered as a whole. But seeing as they don't consider it as a whole themselves, we're not going to either. So, yes.
It's actually larger than the United States. I thought we were still bigger than them.
No, they are slightly larger as far as GDP. If you include the entirety of the European Union, though that's shrinking for multiple reasons.
I bet our GDP.
We're on track to
second quarters.
Yeah,
be higher than theirs.
I believe that will be true. We've been on track to surpass them as far as size of our economy for a while, just because we're growing and they have not been growing for about a decade. A very small growth.
If I just looked at the numbers of the S&P 500 for the week that ended yesterday, the market week that ended yesterday, I would say we are in a really healthy economy. Everything is doing really well. We have a great deal of stability, and we're in a boom because the S&P 500, after having its 32% gain from the bottom back in March, grew 3.2% this week in value.
Right.
Now, 3.2% a week is a phenomenal growth rate in normal times. It is just one of those things that, but the problem is, of course, earnings are declining. The GDP is still falling. We'll probably see this quarter, the second quarter, the greatest fall in GDP since we've been measuring GDP.
Mm-hmm. For a single quarter.
And the market is up 32%, up 3.2% for the week. Closed out, by the way, at 2955.45. If that means anything to you, but it's a magic number we're looking for that it seems to not quite be able to get through of 3,000. And it'll be by the way, if you believe in technical analysis of the market, if it does close above 3,000, that will be very significant. If it stays there for several days above 3,000, the S&P 500, that will be very significant. I don't know if it's going to do it, but it keeps having these little gains, these little 3% gains and 2% gains. So we could very well get there. The Standard Poor's 500 is only down, down 8.52% year to date. It's down 12% almost 13% from its high in February.
And from a weird perspective, if we were aliens observing this society from outer space with no access to radio or television and only somehow tapped into the statistics of the economy, this would be a very confusing time. it's a confusing time anyway, but just looking at the data, up, it's weird. Go ahead.
The market goes up as the bottom falls out of the economy.
Right. And
it's weird.
So to put that piece in perspective, that's relatively normal for the market to be predicting future behavior. But usually they're using numbers to do it with. Right now, it's a gut feeling because nobody knows what the earnings are going to be. And that gut feeling is we're going to get through this and the future is going to be better than the past.
Oh, by the way, for 12 months, and I think this is very important, the S&P 500 is up 4.58% from 1 year ago. That is amazing and astonishing and wonderful and a little scary. In essence, it's saying because of the fact that it's down about 12.7% from its high in February, the market is saying that it thinks collectively, if it thinks, and in a sense it does, that the American corporate economy has had about a 10% permanent or semi-permanent damage done to it.
Yeah.
And whether that's correct or not, nobody knows.
There's some good examples of why that might be close to correct for right now. What is the long-term physical damage to our economy from a plague? Well, you don't have the same physical damage as a hurricane, but the businesses that are employing people that are profitable but they have a very thin margin can fall down, and certainly the zombie companies fall down. So Hertz, the rental car company, which started over 100 years ago with 12 Model Ts as their rental fleet, is declaring bankruptcy. And they've been skirting the edge of bankruptcy on and off since 9/11. Because whenever travel is messed with, rental cars get messed with. And now they're going through this period where nobody is renting cars, and they didn't have enough cash reserves, and they already had debt. They were profitable. They weren't like some of the other zombie companies that we're seeing falling down, the JCPenney's, the Sears and Kmart's that have been just... The Sears and Kmart died before COVID. I'm using them as an example, as a trend for big box retail in-person establishments have been failing for a long time. So when we see Neiman Marcus fall down or JCPenney fall down in the middle of this, we go, oh, those are zombie companies. Well, there are some functional companies that won't exist at the end of this. Hertz is structuring its bankruptcy so that it can come out of bankruptcy because it's still got some profitability forecast.
If it just didn't have any debt.
Right, if it just didn't have any debt. So being in a, that's what bankruptcy is for, is to say, all right, how do we restructure the debt so that the people who are owed the debt get paid something and it doesn't completely destroy this organism that is a company. And it's a very effective method. It's a lot better than what the Japanese do, which is just don't let them go bankrupt. Just restructure it and let them have the debt forever. A little bit like student loans.
The other side of the market, the bond market, is in stark disagreement
with the stock market. That's right.
Now, in a sense, it's agreement. The yield curve is positive, and a positive yield curve says, hey, a year to 18 months from now, things will be okay. A year ago, just for those who haven't tracked this, the yield curve was negative. In other words, it had a big sag in it where short-term interest rates were higher than long-term interest rates, which is a pretty effective way of saying we're going to have a recession.
Yeah, we were talking about having a recession. We were even saying we'll probably have a black swan that leads us into a fairly mild recession. It'll be a boring one, nothing like the last one. We should be no problems. Something will knock us over into it. Well, the thing that knocked us over into it had a shovel. It may have been digging as it was knocking us down the hole.
I think since dinosaurs are the ancestors of swans, this was a black T-Rex.
Yes, this was, a black T-Rex. And we say this regularly, but to let people know what we're talking about with the black swan, the statisticians in England in the Renaissance would give numbers for their arguments, but they would also use a term that's like finding a black swan. And in England and Europe, there are no black swans. They're all white swans. So they were saying, like, when pigs fly. So when we talk about a black swan, we're talking about that. The big stark reminder is that black swans are real, and when Australia was discovered, that's the kind of swans they have. It's all the swans in Australia. There are some white swans there now, but they're European white swans. So just as a side note, when we say that thing is not possible, it's never happened before, it doesn't mean we're right. So this happens to be a Tyrannosaurus version of a black swan.
The yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury, which is the benchmark we use, is 0.661%. I mean, now, not 6.61, but 0.661. In other words, if you loan your money to the federal government, they will pay you, they will gladly pay you 6.6 tenths, 0.661% per year for 10 years if you'll loan them the money.
10 years at a 0.6% rate.
And you're not guaranteed that you'll get your money back on the loan. Unless you hold it to maturity.
Right.
And to give you some idea how absurd this is, people were complaining they were only getting 1.something% from their CDs and from short-term treasuries recently.
Yeah, just 4 months ago.
And the 30-year treasury bond, in other words, you didn't use a broker, you didn't have to pay any commissions, you didn't have any transaction costs, you went straight to the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, which you can do, and you pay $1,000 for a 30-year U.S. Treasury bond.
I think they issue them in $10,000 increments.
Well, the $10,000 are notes. They will issue $1,000 treasury.
Will they? This is not something I knew about. I know you can buy them through a broker, but I didn't realize you could buy them directly that way.
Yeah, you can go Treasury Direct, it's called. And
okay.
You go in there and you send them a check or a transfer of money and then some form for $1,000, and they will issue you a real treasury bond. Now, they don't issue you the piece of paper. It's on deposit at the treasury.
So they issue a piece of electronic information.
But the 30-year treasury bond is paying 1.32% a year. So if you wanted to get 1.32%, which you used to be able to get just a few months ago on a CD.
Or a money market.
Or a money market. You have to lend the money to the United States Treasury for 30 years. And we use that as a benchmark. That is the safe interest rate. Anytime that you are getting more than 1.32% or less than 30 years, you are taking a risk of default.
Or if we look at the 0.66 on the 10, that's the no-risk rate we're talking about. As long as you leave it to maturity.
And the shorter-term 90-day T-bill is like it's less than a tenth of a percent. It's around a tenth of a percent. It varies up and down day by day.
Now, just to be pedantic again and to let the listeners know something they probably already know about us, in schooling, when they were teaching me the risk-free rate, I'd already been in business for quite some time in the financial world when I was getting my designation. And they said, and this is called the zero risk rate or the risk-free rate. It's the U.S. government maturity, and you hold it to maturity, it's zero risk. And I said, what? And they said, yes, it's zero risk. And I'm like, black swan. I'm not suggesting that the government will suddenly stop paying its debt for no reason. But there have been massive meteor strikes and volcanic explosions in the past that I consider part of risk that might remove the ability to receive your finance. But as far as reasonability in the financial markets, it's a zero risk position. I think it's quite humorous because they don't consider things like what killed the dinosaurs risk. You can't do anything about it, and the government can't guarantee it won't happen. So,
those happen about once every 20 million years, so I think the probability of them happening is
low.
Not something we should worry about too much.
Low is not no. That's all I'm saying. And, you know, if we're going to be so pedantic and get out to the 12th decimal point on the price of a mutual fund, then I think we should look at the 12th decimal point on the risk of catastrophe and say that's not zero.
That's certainly true.
That's how weird we are, guys. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon, but I don't like saying no risk when there are other things out there.
That's true. But the interest rates on the Treasury securities, because they're so low, and generally speaking, bond interest rates are so astonishingly low, what the Treasury market, the Treasury yield curve, is effectively predicting is a recovery in 12 to 18 months, but it's going to be a very muted recovery, a very anemic recovery with very low interest rates. In other words, they are anticipating no chance of any significant inflation. They're anticipating the market is effectively predicting zero inflation or near zero inflation.
Right.
And it's also predicting that there will not be a great demand by companies to go out and people to go out and borrow a lot of money and raise interest rates, because if there's a lot of demand for borrowed money, if people want to borrow a lot of money because they want to buy things, then the interest rates tend to go up. It's a supply and demand issue. And what the bond market is saying and what the stock market are saying, in essence, are completely opposite things. And I don't think I've ever seen this degree of opposition between the two, and I don't think anybody understands it. This is, you know, one of the things that used to be that as a matter of fact, I've said this before, the things that you always want to avoid and believe are not true, or somebody says it's different this time or this could go on forever. Well, this could go on forever is probably out the window still.
Yeah.
But it's very definitely different this time.
Well, it's different in our recordings. And this is the thing, you know, when we're looking at market behavior, we've never had a worldwide shutdown of the economy for a pandemic ever. Not ever. And, I mean, we've had pandemics that decimated the population so badly, knocked it, and more than decimated, cut the population by 60% in Europe at different times in the past. But we didn't have market data to look at. And if we had, it wouldn't have made any sense anyway. It would have been completely irrelevant because nobody cares how much money they have if they've died. So this is a first as far as we're concerned.
That's speculative now. We don't know because we've never talked to anybody who's died.
Well, I've talked to them. They just haven't talked back.
Ah, well, we got two questions that got emailed in.
All right. I wasn't seeing anything.
Well, one of them is there's an article in the Wall Street Journal that says that the Federal Reserve could do yield curve control.
They already are.
Well, but only at one end. They're not actually going out long term and trying to control the, matter of fact,
not on the government side, yeah.
Chairman Powell has very specifically said that they're not ready to use yield curve control yet. The other one is the have and had not. Same listener, John, said that that he still hears that there are millions of Americans who still haven't recovered from the Great Recession after a decade of stock market gains. And with the current crisis, will the divide between the haves and have-nots continue to grow despite the prediction of a coming roaring 20s? Two different questions.
Yeah, but good, very good, deep questions.
Yes. And there, we could talk the whole hour about that second one.
Right. It's very tempting for me to just jump into that conversation because...
Let's talk about yield curve control first.
Yeah, let's do that first. This is an easy answer and we'll get it out of the way.
Now, whether or not it would work, and that's one of the reasons the Federal Reserve is very hesitant to use it, is the yield curve is an indicator by the bond market of where they think the economy is going, of the collective wisdom of all the people who are buying and selling bonds. And there is a theory that says if you control the indicator, you control the economy. Now, whether or not that's true... is questionable because it's never really been tried before, but it's a hypothetical theory. It's a hypothesis more than a theory.
Right.
And they're very hesitant to do it.
There's a lot of counter argument to it.
It's kind of like trying to control the value of a currency by the central bank buying and selling that currency. And it should be able to control import and export rates. It should have tremendous effect on the economy. If the central bank is buying or selling dollars or yen or whatever their currency is, because raising the price of the currency would hurt exports and speed up imports, and lowering the price of the currency would speed up exports and theoretically be good for the economy, but it's never been successful.
Right. So the lowering the price of the currency is in effect inflation. You need more of the currency to buy something. And so the Central Bank of the United States has a target of 2%. Not that we're likely to be near that anytime soon. They want a little bit of inflation. What that does long term is if you hold a mortgage, it means, here's a great example. I just refinanced my mortgage. I'm in the process, not quite closed yet, but it's coming along. 3.125%. That's the number. The 43-year average inflation for the United States is 3.45%. So if we had just the average inflation during that time period, I'd be getting paid, in essence, to have my mortgage. I still have to pay that back, that principal, but the principal is less and less each year with inflation. The flip side of that is deflation, when the dollar becomes worth more.
Of course,
go ahead.
The bond market is now predicting effectively zero inflation going forward for the next 30 years.
That's correct.
And that's one of the issues that you have to deal with. And congratulations on getting your mortgage rate lowered, by the way.
Yeah, it's still happening, okay. And that's an important thing that people know. You can jump out there and still do that we may see or may not see. There's a lot of there's contradictory evidence. We may see a dip in the price of houses in the next few months. We may also see house prices go up in
well,
the next few months.
We've actually started to see the anecdotally, we're seeing that the price of housing is dropping because the sales are dropping.
Right.
But we'll see how that works. There's the other thing about the yield curve. The thing about the yield curve is the Fed theoretically can go up. For instance, the United States has just started issuing 20-year bonds again, which, by the way, got there was about $12.50 of bids for every dollar the United States wanted to borrow for 20 years. Which is a very, very good ratio. In other words,
yeah.
there was a clamoring to buy a 20-year bond.
This is why the interest rate is so low, because they don't have to negotiate to keep their interest rate low. There's $12 available for every dollar that they need.
Well, theoretically, the Federal Reserve could go out and, for instance, start buying 10-year or 20-year bonds, 10-year notes, 20-year bonds, and if they bought them, it lowers interest rates. In other words, if the interest rates, you know, the long term were to get too high and threaten to pull us into inflation, theoretically, the Federal Reserve could go out and start buying a lot of them.
And that would
lower interest rates.
Right, yeah.
And if the interest rates got too low, they could go out and sell them. Well, they figured out pretty quickly that trying to keep inflation up, theoretically, what they would be doing is they'd be going out and buying short-term securities, which they've been doing, which converts the treasury securities into cash, which people would then spend and which should raise inflation.
Except they weren't spending; they were just turning around and buying another treasury security worth more money. Yeah.
And we've got a problem that you can't affect the psychology of investors by buying and selling things. The psychology stays the same. Matter of fact, one of the things that an article that I want to talk about today. The savings rate in the United States has jumped to about 20%. It's the highest it's ever been since we've been tracking the numbers. In other words, you look at the amount of money that people have coming into their households in the United States. You look at the money they're spending, and there's a 20% differential.
What is the date on this?
This is this week.
Okay. So it's the new savings rate after COVID has hit.
Yeah, and the question is, of course, is this because people are staying home and they're just not spending money, or is this a major change? And the surveys are suggesting this is a major change. And but how long it'll last, we don't know. But there's a lot of people who are receiving unemployment benefits right now, and the high unemployment benefits go away at the end of July, or sometime in July. I don't know if it's July 1st or the end of July, but in July the high unemployment rate payments go away, and they drop. For some people, are making $900 a week, and
this is something we definitely wanted to say. This, if you don't mind me breaking in, if you're receiving the raised unemployment right now, and you're not sure you're going to have your job when the unemployment benefit drops back down, we suggest you save it too.
So, yes, and yeah. That's what people are doing.
Yeah,
and there's a strong. The mere fact that twice in 10 years we've had large-scale unemployment probably will shape a generation of savers, similarly to the way the Great Depression shaped a generation of savers. The people who experienced the Great Depression had high savings rates. Now, we don't have, by the way, this is not the Great Depression.
No, it's not. There's a
lot of different, set of data.
Completely different.
And we're not going to have a Great Depression, but what we have is a situation where we've had the largest number of people laid off and suddenly realize that they don't have money coming in that we've had since we've been measuring these things. And the end result is that people previously were cruising along and say, I have a steady job, I don't need to worry about it. They may be working in a fire, even people like firefighters and police officers who think they have a steady job, or they're working for the government, or they're working for a large corporation, and they say there's no
airline pilot. Yeah.
I have no risk at all.
Airline
and
pilots
suddenly,
said that quite a lot until recently.
And now they have suddenly realized that their job is not a permanent issue, even working for the government. Even if you're a teacher, you think, well, if I'm a teacher, I'm completely secure, but we're probably going to see teacher layoffs across the country this fall.
Yeah, and we're not talking about because school's not reopened. That's not the case. It's looking down the road, where do revenues come from to pay teachers? Well, they come from taxes. If we look at delinquency rates on mortgages and delinquency rates on property taxes, delinquent and the low sales tax figures, what we can say is the source of revenue that pays teachers in a lot of places in the United States has completely dried up.
And most states have a zero-based budgeting rule based in their very constitution of the states. The state of Texas cannot go into debt. It can borrow money, but it has to have something to offset it. But the point is that you can't run a deficit on the state budget, cannot run a deficit. And when next time the legislature meets, they're going to look, there's no doubt about this, they're going to look at increased expenditures on the books already and decreased revenue. We're probably going to have to dip into the rainy day fund. And the natural response, the legal response, the constitutional response of the state of Texas is going to be to cut spending. And one of the biggest spending issues for the state of Texas is education. So when the biggest element, the biggest expense in education is not the school buildings, which they do through local bond issues, it is from, it's the teacher pay. So you can draw this out and say, unless there are some massive grants by the federal government to the states to pay teachers, we're going to have fewer teachers in the future than we have today, even though we have more kids. And that's going to be a really hard thing for the state legislature to deal with, but they're going to have to deal with it because we, our Constitution forbids us to have a deficit. Not that it should do any other ways, but, I mean, the federal government has enough deficit to make up for all the states not having deficits.
Yeah, well, I mean, it may not have it in its pocket, but we'll figure out a way. This is part of the conversation that I was having yesterday. We've got some commercials that we need to play. But
oh, yeah.
But kind of baseline, there are a lot of difficult decisions that have to be made in the coming years. There's a huge amount of good stuff that's coming out of this. There's also a huge amount of long-term negatives that we're going to have to deal with. Social Security is going to go bust a lot sooner than we thought. The Social Security Trust Fund was forecast as of April of this year, based on numbers to the end of 2019, so not counting, man, what do we call 2020? Dumpster fire. Not counting dumpster fire.
I think we just put a name on the financial crisis, the economic
the dumpster
crisis.
Dumpster fire of 2020.
Dumpster fire of 2020.
So all of our numbers are stinky and burned right now. We don't know what's coming out of this, except there's a lot of smoke. What we can say is that all of our estimates from the end of 2019 on Social Security, saying the trust fund goes broke in 2035. Well, 2035 sounds science fiction-y to a lot of people, but that's 15 years from now, which means that my son will still be in high school. That's not very far away, and that was the good news estimate before COVID hit, when we've had cuts to payroll taxes and a lot of people not paying payroll taxes because they don't have income. They still have to pay income taxes, but they don't pay payroll taxes. That unemployment insurance isn't going toward, I think it's hilarious that the federal government is throwing money at the unemployment thing and then taking money right back out of it in taxes. It's as weird as anything else that's going on. Anyway, do you want to say anything before we hit the commercial?
I want to answer the haves and have-nots questions from John after the commercials.
I agree with that. That sounds good. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. This, if you would like to ask a question, our email addresses are jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. That's the Personal Wealth Coach or Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie.com. And we're reading those. Unfortunately, the budget cuts at the studio mean we have one phone line, and that's it.
So we'll go with that. The one phone line is being taken up by Elder Baldy. We'll be back on the other side of these very important public service announcements with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. And we're back here to talk about such wonderfully exciting conversation topics as disease, economic depression, and then the optimistic side of where we'll be in a few years. So I'm going to bring Elder Baldy back up. Let's do the quick switch, and here you go.
I'm back, I think.
All right, you are back.
You know, John asked about the have and have-nots, that there are millions of Americans that haven't recovered from the Great Recession. That's probably true. Is it going to get worse? Absolutely. The bottom line to this thing, we're already seeing it happen, is if you can work from home digitally, if you're capable of handling your computer and you're doing office work before, and you can do it from home and you have a good internet connection and you have a good computer and you're very able to use those things, you probably still have your job and you probably still have an income and you're probably doing all right. But a lot, for instance, low skill jobs like the people working in the meatpacking industry are very highly exposed to the COVID virus right now. They're getting sick at a high rate of speed, and the industry finds itself potentially being devastated by the fact that it has people working there. And everything that you do that doesn't require education, doesn't require some specific education, and doesn't require a thought process is capable of being done by a robot, by some digital device.
Yeah. And let me throw this out there to talk the trend. We still have migrant laborers in the United States, and they're not all illegal aliens. So we have people that go that do the harvest season, and they'll go to California, they'll go to Illinois. There's a whole series of places that they go. We've been moving to robotics to replace that because even that low wage is more expensive than what they pay in Guatemala for the same job. And the balance point is how much does it cost to ship the food from Guatemala to the United States? And if that cost is less than paying people in the United States to harvest, your cost is going to be higher than the Guatemalan price. So we've been moving to automate for years. Broccoli is one of those, you know, people think about broccoli. What's big deal about broccoli? They get stuff on them from the wind. They get particles of plastic and such. If you show up at the store with a load of broccoli to, not at the store, at the buyer, with a load of broccoli, and they see plastic trash in the broccoli, they can refuse the whole load. They do refuse the whole load. So one of the jobs of a broccoli farmer is to vacuum their crops while they're still growing. They walk around with a backpack vacuum cleaner and vacuum their crops. Well, that costs money. A robot can do that and will be doing that in the near future. So haves and have-nots, let's kind of, I want to touch this last piece and then I'm going to hand it right back to you. The haves and have-nots have been separating for about 40 years. But at the same time, the have-nots have a lot more than they did 40 years ago. If we look at quality of life, standard of living, what we consider poverty today was actually considered pretty wealthy 40 years ago. So our standard of living has risen so that who we consider have-nots is different than what they would have been considered the haves 40 years ago. So this is kind of the thing. It doesn't make it better to go home to less than what someone else has. But just to be clear on this, even in the middle of this crisis, people have refrigerators in their house. They have air conditioning. They have heating. They have all of these things that were considered great luxuries before. So behaviorally, we have to be careful when we say statistically the haves and have-nots have been dividing over the last 40 years, because everybody's standard of living has risen during that time period. And if we look back to the recession, there's a lot of evidence that shows that maybe on an investment side, some people haven't recovered from the Great Recession. But the people that stayed invested, so long as the company they were invested in didn't disappear, the vast majority of them have recovered. It's the people that got out of investing because of it in the recession, the Great Recession, that are very clearly not recovered. And people that lost their jobs that didn't retrain, that clearly have not recovered. Now, that sounds like I'm pointing the finger at them like it's their fault. It isn't. There's nobody out there guiding them saying this is what you need to do. But we have to be careful when the haves and have-nots are separating. Even the have-nots are having more. And that's been a consistent trend throughout the history of the United States going all the way back. Haves and have-nots have been separating for the last 40 years. But if we look back at the 1920s through the 1950s, we saw the opposite. And if you look back from the 1870s up through the 1920s, we saw what we see today. So when we have these technological revolutions, it's very normal. I'm sorry I took so much time to touch on that little point, but...
No, that's not a little point. It's a major issue to understand that when I was a kid, I can literally say I was in the have-nots. We didn't have indoor plumbing. We didn't have a lot of the things that people consider to be perfectly normal and natural and required today. And I can say that the have-nots of today, the people deep in poverty today, other than those who are mentally ill and are living in a homeless environment, live better than what I considered rich people when I was a kid. And I'm 70. And so my perspective on that is a little different, but that's the reality of where things are.
Yeah, one last quick thing is to be really clear. The statistics don't show this. You have to look deeper. But a really good example of this is the top 1% of earners. 95% of that top 1% is different from one year to the next, which means it's really the top 0.05% that are consistently in the top 1% that a lot of the have-nots are pointing at.
And we're all getting better. Adam Smith is working. But when it comes to the spread between the high-income people and the low-income people, relatively speaking, that spread is going to probably continue to widen for a while. And the reason, again, is there's two big reasons. One is geography. Unfortunately, if you happen to live in the mountains of West Virginia, unless you have some source of income that has nothing to do with your employment, you're probably not making a lot of money.
Well,
on the other hand, if you're living in Austin, Texas, you probably are making a relatively large amount of money compared with the people who live in the mountains of West Virginia.
Yeah.
If you're living in Detroit, you're probably not making a tremendous amount of money because they have more people who want to work than they have jobs consistently. So the lack of mobility has a lot to do with the divide between the haves and the have-nots. In the 1920s, and we're in many ways repeating the 1920s, the people who lived on the farms across the country who were workers who lived near the farms and they worked, which had been going on for literally a couple of thousand years.
At least, maybe more.
And it was pretty steady work in agriculture. I mean, somebody had to get behind that mule and plow that field, and somebody had to weed those crops, and somebody had to pick those crops, and they didn't have migrant workers doing that. Those people had to leave home.
It was John Boy doing that. That's who that was.
Right. And they had to leave home and go find someplace to work. And mass migration set in the 1920s. And it got worse in the 1930s, but the agricultural workers were largely displaced in the 1920s. Well, there's going to be a lot of workers in the next 10 years displaced. And this coronavirus crisis that we're going through here, Jake called it the dumpster fire crisis, is going to be one that accelerates that move, just like the recession it's called the Forgotten Depression of 1920-21 did. It accelerates that move. Just like a lot of zombie companies, companies that were marginally profitable or maybe not profitable and getting by on borrowed money like JCPenney or Sears or Hertz, are seeing the blow occur directly. But it's been coming a long time, and it is not the coronavirus that's putting Hertz under. It's the fact that they didn't adapt. It's the fact that JCPenney and Macy's and Dillard's are going away because they didn't adapt, whereas Walmart is thriving because it adapted. And Walmart, a lot of Walmart's business right now, their profits are not up that much, but their revenue is up tremendously, and it's up mainly in online services.
We're about out of time.
Yeah, okay. Time has gone by fast.
Yeah, you get excited.
Yeah. Well, we need to close out the show.
Yeah, if you would, and I'm going to tone down your mic and pick mine up. Yes, the first hour is done.
If you would like to contact us off the air, we actually do give individual advice. The phone number is 254-947-1111. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can read our newsletters and listen to our recordings from shows going back a great distance. You can email us directly, jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. Until next hour, this has been The Person.